Chairman. Good afternoon, everyone. We're going to move through our agenda here, starting off with Senate Bill 262, and then go on to fun with the kicker. So let's start with opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 262. Before we go, can you give us a brief summary? Jamie?
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. This bill is in regards to multi-unit low-income housing. It extends to 2032 the sunset on a program currently in statute which permits cities and counties to grant a property tax exemption for multi-unit rental housing. It affects two different programs, low-income multi-unit rental housing and multi-unit rental housing in designated areas such as light rail or mass transit area. These are currently in effect and in use by several counties. And according to the most recent tax expenditure report, the use of this program is at $13.7 million per biennium.
Okay. We've seen this one before. Representative Nose, did you want to come forward?
Are you ready?
Sir.
Sorry, yes. I'm having a little trouble with my voice here. Chair Haas, Vice Chair Bentz, members of the committee, sorry about my cold here. For the record, my name is Rob Nose, and I represent House District 42, which is inner southeast and northeast Portland. It's part of Senator Taylor's district. I'm pleased to be here to help introduce Senate Bill 262, which comes to you, I'm told, on a unanimous vote from your housing committee. The bill extends the sunset of the multi-unit limited tax exemption, also known as the multi-program, for another 10 years to the year 2032. Cities and counties have the option to implement this program and provide up to a 10-year property tax exemption for qualifying multi-unit housing developments. Property tax exemption programs like multi provide local jurisdictions and developers with another tool to incentivize the development of housing. Currently, the cities of Portland and Eugene implement this program. In Portland, multi is used as an economic incentive for the development of affordable housing. And just in the last 3 years, over 850 affordable units have been created under this program, as I've been told by my city. This tax exemption is a pretty key incentive used in conjunction with Portland's inclusionary housing program, and that contributes to a comprehensive approach to addressing the housing crisis in our city. By extending the sunset date of the multi-unit limited tax exemption, Senate Bill 262 will continue to create affordable housing options for our communities. So I respectfully urge your support.
Thank you, sir. I'm sure the city and county appreciate you advocating for them.
I think
any
they do.
Any questions for?
They wouldn't have asked me to come here if they.
Representative,
if they didn't.
Oh gosh.
Okay.
No, I'll make it easy.
Is it really hard?
It's easy, right?
Okay.
Believe it or not, Representative, after all those days of locked in private conferences back in the old days,
yes.
I'm going to give you
a yes, no,
and you just have to answer yes. So I'll give this to you before. I'm just sort of laying this up for you.
All right, I'm ready.
My assumption is the normal sunset is 6 years, but given the dynamics of housing and trying to provide some certainty for long-term financing, the reason we want to have a 10-year sunset on this is to allow it to be able to reach out and actually develop more units that might not be as cost-effective. And so by having it for a longer period as normal, that we normally do in here allows us to reach out and get more affordable housing constructed, correct?
Senator Haas, the answer to the senator's question is yes.
I think point of clarification, I don't think it's not, I had a similar question this morning and I was educated that this is because it's not a tax credit, it's an exemption. So that's why it's not following the 6 year rule, but we should have staff.
It's a property tax thing, but also, they do want to go out longer because they want to give more certainty, Senator Taylor, to folks that are in this space.
Well, I just want to make sure it's not a credit.
It could be both.
It can be both.
Both could be true, Senator Haas.
Yeah, I'm trying to help you here, Senator, right? But I could point out that there are plenty of people
really?
Who want to repeal all of these every 2 years. If you want to go to that end of the spectrum.
Jeez, okay.
You don't want to go there, right?
Can I go, Senator Haas? I'd like to leave. I'm supposed to be in committee.
All right. You're excused. Thank you. Eric Knoll, Dory Van Bockel, and Amanda D'Souza.
So it's a pleasure to be here, Senator. We're finding it finance, right? It's finance.
Good afternoon, Chair Haas, Vice Chair Benz, and members of the committee. For the record, Eric Knoll with the City of Portland, here with my colleague Dory Van Bockel from the Portland Housing Bureau. My role today will be to briefly introduce the bill and then turn it over to my colleague to provide more details of how Portland implements the multiple unit limited tax exemption. We do have an accompanying presentation on OLIS to provide statistics. Senate Bill 262, as you heard, extends the sunset of ORS 307-600 through 637 for 10 years from January 1st, 2022 to January 1st, 2032. And I want to touch on a few key points before I turn it over to my colleague. The first is that the multi-program is one in a range of tools and approaches available to local communities to incentivize the development of public benefits, and in this case, affordable housing. Local leaders have this tool, and it's a strategic public investment tool to advance housing and community goals. In evaluating whether or not to implement the program, local jurisdictions must weigh the choices and subsequent costs from the abatement very carefully and effectively as a trade-off for those public benefits. And then it's up to local communities to balance development goals with the revenue impacts. This tool has been in statute since 1975. It was last reauthorized in the 2011 session for 10 years to 2022. The reason, as you heard before, that the sunset is on a 10-year period is particularly for housing property tax exemptions. It provides more certainty to developers in the development cycle, which is another reason why we are coming during this session rather than in 2021 with the request to extend the sunset, is to provide that certainty for developers and to continue using a tool that is proven in the cities of Portland and Eugene to have an effective history in creating affordable and workforce housing units. So with that, thank you very much. Happy to answer any questions at the end, and I'll turn it over to my colleague.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Haas, Vice Chair Benz, and the rest of the committee. My name is Dory Van Bockel. I am a program manager with the City of Portland's Housing Bureau and working on this program as well as several other exemptions and tools that we have available in our suite of a broad spectrum of programs supporting affordable housing within the City of Portland. We do have a presentation that's, so, yep. Just wanted to go through a few things about the history of the program and how enabling jurisdiction of the City of Portland utilizes the program. So first of all, this 307-600 to 637 offers a 10-year property exemption for developments. Eligible projects are generally new construction, but it is possible to any new units that get added to either a rehabilitation or conversion of another structure is able to utilize the program. So as mentioned by Eric, adopting jurisdictions select locally from the most what community benefits they wish to see based on their own planning and what works in the development community as well to find a program that will be successful. And we can say over the years that by making different decisions, therefore, we've been able to see different levels of success in how the program has been used. If we don't have that balance right, it's not a program that works, right? So examples, as mentioned already, affordable housing, transit-oriented development are a couple of the ways that the program's been used over the years. So at least 51% of taxing jurisdictions affected by the foregone revenue need to adopt the program. So both in the case of the City of Eugene and the City of Portland, we've had to come up with that across our affected jurisdictions. Otherwise, for instance, if we adopted it as the City of Portland alone, we'd only be able to forego revenue attributed to the city itself. And each application that's reviewed for each property does go through an application process and approval that's actually through, for us, the City Council through an ordinance. And the exemption itself does apply to the residential improvements of the property. There are some provisions to include commercial if it meets a public need, but the land remains taxable during the property tax exemption timeline. And obviously the property goes back on the full tax rolls post the 10-year period. So as mentioned by Eric, the city's had a version of this program since inception in 1975. Among the goals in the past have been transit-oriented development, urban development within the central city, and including affordability. Most recently, since 2017, the program has been used in conjunction with the city's inclusionary housing program. And so in using the program in this way for the city, we're able to engage the private market to participate in adding affordable housing or other public benefits in the history of the program. And then as most recently, affordable housing is the key public benefit that the city of Portland has engaged in order to use this program. So with the affordable housing within the city of Portland, I mentioned that there are several different programs that the city uses to promote affordability. There's obviously programs assisting homelessness all the way up into homeownership, and along that spectrum, traditionally, the Multi's been able to work by promoting housing at the 60% to 80% of median family income range. Sometimes this is used with a more broadly affordable, deeper affordable project, but primarily the benefit of the tax exemption is not significant enough that it can offset rents at a deeper affordability. And so this is a tool that can kind of pick up where some of our direct funding, gap financing that the city uses, tax increment finance and other programming to assist with the development of those units. Can kind of, this is the next step from that then within that spectrum. So to talk about a little bit how the programs worked with inclusionary housing, since 2017, February of that year, all new projects within the city adding 20 or more units have been required to provide some affordable housing in some shape or form. There's a handful of options. The minimum requirement is 20% of units at 80% of median family income over a period of 99 years. There are options to provide fewer units if they're at 60% of area median income, or also to provide units off-site, either in a new development or an existing building, at a deeper affordability rate. There's also an option for developers to pay a fee in lieu rather than participating in providing the affordable units. As part of that, the Multi is one of the important incentives to help make projects such as those feasible. Additionally, the city offers a system development charge exemption for any of the affordable units, as well as exemptions from the affordable housing construction excise tax. And developments providing the affordability or paying the fee in lieu are able to receive additional density bonus and potentially exemption from some parking. Currently in the pipeline for inclusionary housing over these last couple of years, we have over 400 units that will be restricted again for 99 years at either 60 or 80% maximum median family income. And as you can see from the map too, that they are located all over the city. So the white and blue buildings are for projects that are within permitting already, and those with the sort of black arrows represent any projects that are under review for early assistance or other pre-application review. This is an example of one of the buildings over the last several years that has used the Multi program in the city of Portland. It's the Block 8L Apartments. It's called 38 Davis now, as it has come on the market, and is a mixed income, mixed use project with office and mixed income apartments in the Old Town Chinatown neighborhood around a couple of different university sites, and is one of the first developments in that area to offer any market rate housing in a very long time. So it's been the program's been really helpful to catalyze that. Another project is in the Pearl District on the edge of I-405. So a lot of development going on in that area. 14th and Gleason by Holland Development. They have a handful of projects that they applied for over the last couple of years prior to inclusionary housing going into effect. But these will be coming on the market pretty soon with 46 affordable units. As far as to look at the need within the city of Portland, in our latest state of housing report, we published information to show that at least 55,000 people are paying more than 30% of their income on a regular basis for housing, and you know, representing a severe cost burdening that makes it harder for them to be stable with where they're living and support their families. And they're having to make those choices for other expenses and or with housing and over those other expenses. So with that, 6,000 to 7,000 of those families are at the 60 to 80% of income range, whereas there's even a larger number for people earning less than 60% of median family income. So there's certainly a need for this type of housing. So we do have two other programs that the city actively administers for with limited tax exemptions. The nonprofit limited tax exemption program is used by nonprofit low-income housing providers. And so the projects that receive our direct financing, gap financing within the city, those that are low-income housing tax credit projects, those type of projects that have a nonprofit limited partner, are generally using this program, which within the city that will exempt the land and the structural improvements, and it's available on an ongoing basis with an annual certification process. And that's available for any of the tenants in the building earning up to 60% of median family income. So that's widely used. It's the most broadly used exemption program within the city of Portland. The multi-program is primarily used for rental projects. There are a handful of condominium units over the years that have used the program in order to make some homeownership multifamily housing available. And again, there's about 1,250 units that within the 16-17 tax year, the last report out we have from the county at that point in time, that were on the tax rolls for that program. And then we also have the Home Buyer Opportunity Limited Tax Exemption Program, which offers a 10-year tax exemption for home ownership units. So it's used, we have a local cap on that, but we approve up to 100 new units each year for small developers, primarily within doing infill development within the city of Portland. We have no cap for any of our nonprofit partners who are able to use the program as well. So we work a lot with Habitat for Humanity and a couple of different land trust organizations within the city as well. So to look at some of the most recent multi-activity, our numbers are growing actually with the use of the program. In the last couple of years, we can see some numbers of how things have changed since it's been part of the multi-2. There's a large fluctuation in the amount of foregone revenue per unit or even per project based on the location of units across the city, you know, the amount of amenities, the size of the whole building, as well as within the inclusionary housing program outside of the central city, we're only offering a tax exemption on the affordable units within the building, just based on the feasibility analysis of the need in order to make those projects pencil out, compared to within the central city, because of concrete steel construction and a lot larger cost to actually get those buildings out of the ground. In doing the financial analysis to develop the inclusionary housing program, those projects actually receive a full tax exemption of the whole residential improvements. Land
I don't mean to interrupt, but
yes.
We kind of need you to wrap up this.
Sure. Yep, and this is actually the end. So.
Okay. Thank you.
You're
Okay, Chair Hass, Vice Chair Benz, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Amanda D'Souza, and I am here on behalf of the City of Eugene to ask that you support the passing of Senate Bill 262, which would provide for an extension of the property tax exemption for multi-unit housing. The program is known in Eugene as the Multi-Unit Property Tax Exemption, or MUPD. The basic aim of MUPD is to encourage new, high-quality housing in our city's core, to encourage higher densities, and to encourage compact growth instead of urban sprawl. By delaying tax collection, the city is incentivizing the long-term increase of its tax base, which ultimately benefits the overlapping taxing districts. As shown in my submitted testimony, the MUPD has expired on 12 projects, all of which are not now taxed. The combined revenue of those 12 projects last year was about $960,000. In absence of the residential development, those 12 properties would have generated about $74,000. In addition, the current statute's flexibility has allowed us to customize the tool so that it can help us achieve other community-wide goals. In 2013, our city council suspended the MUPD program and underwent an intensive two-year review, engaging with several community stakeholder groups to revise the program. Since it was relaunched in 2015, applicants must meet seven public benefit criteria to receive their exemption. These criteria include compact urban development, green building features, a local economic impact plan, a moderate income housing contribution, project design compatibility, historic and existing housing sensitivity, and project need. The revised program also guidelines also include the creation of a review panel, which provides a third-party review of applications and the overall program. Increasing the supply of housing in our downtown can help the community work toward our broader community goals, including climate recovery, encouraging a vibrant downtown, and fiscal sustainability. The downtown housing vacancy rate has been at or near zero for many years in Eugene, but there has been virtually no new construction. This points to some basic economic deficiencies. Generally, the cost of new construction is high, and the low market rents are too low to support any new development in the down core. In fact, since 1990, all downtown market rate housing developments have used a MUPD. And in some recent cases, we have seen that MUPD isn't even enough. We've had a local number of firms work to build housing, only to discontinue their planning as the projects could not pencil. And of the two projects that have been approved since 2015, only one has actually been able to break ground so far. A 10-year extension of the statute will allow us to continue offering a significant tool to help shift a housing project to being financially feasible, while leveraging the tool to help achieve public benefits that positively impact the broader community. On behalf of the City of Eugene, thank you for the opportunity to present our position, and we request your support of Senate Bill 262.
Thank you. Do we have any questions or panel? I appreciate your, Senator Boquist.
No, that way. There's a hand waving down there.
Senator Benz, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We had an interesting conversation yesterday with some folks that were here regarding affordable housing, and one of the things that was brought to our attention was the need for care when it came to how much people were earning so they could afford the rents to afford moving on, I'm going to call it up the ladder. That led me to think, as you were making your presentation, to ask what the movement through these units is. Do people that move in, because of the, I'm going to guess they don't leave, given the incredibly low rate of other available housing, but perhaps I'm wrong. Is this affordable housing a place where people move in and then move out later as their circumstances improve? Or is it something long-term because they have no other alternatives? Or give me a view, because what I'm trying to link here is we're working really hard on housing, and I'm glad of it. But are we also working really hard on trying to drive up that which people are earning to allow, as you said, the project to become more financially feasible? So just share with me that rather broad question. Answer any part of it you like.
Sure, I can take a stab at that. Thank you, Senator Bentz. And Vice Chair, again, I'm Dori Van Bockel with the Housing Bureau. And we see generally turnover within affordable housing portfolio is much lower than within the general market. But at the 60 to 80% level, we do see more transition than people that are at much lower income levels that need a lot more support sometimes. But even with a supportive housing model, we definitely, the aim of the programming and the services that are provided with the affordable housing is to help people improve their situations and their stability in order to then move into other opportunities.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Benz.
Yes, I didn't quite hear, I didn't expect specific numbers, but give me an estimate. Do 80% of the people that are in these new units stay, or 20% move on? What I'm really trying to get at here is, one, I want to focus on having affordable housing, but I also wonder if we are focusing enough on making sure we're retaining good paying jobs in the community mm-hmm. that will help them afford housing that isn't necessarily subsidized.
We can certainly follow up with more precise information from our portfolio as to how long people are living within the affordable units. What I could say is that, you know, as you could see from the map, that the units are all across the city, which is another benefit for workforce housing, particularly so that people are able to go to school, be at jobs across the city, and not having to commute as much as well.
Final follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Benz.
So the question would be the demand for these units. I'm guessing that the demand has been going up as opposed to being stable. Can you give me your best guess of why? Is it because we have more and more people moving into the state that need that kind of assistance, or is it something else?
Yes, Vice Chair Benz, again, we can thank you for that question. We definitely see, as I showed by the demand, the need. It's been ongoing, certainly, that affordable units are in demand, and it goes across the spectrum from the need for homeless services across the board to the need for 60 to 80% housing. I am not an economist. I can't really say the overall trends of the market and the job situation, but within the housing, we certainly do work with a number of different nonprofit providers across the spectrum, where we do see families transitioning from one either into from a project such as one of these within the multi-program into home ownership, for instance. So that is something that we have seen happen. I don't have exact numbers.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Well, thank you for coming forward, Eric, especially thanks to you for educating members of the committee beforehand, so took away a lot of the questions they may have had. So
thank you.
Appreciate that. And we will, if there's no one else scheduled here or signed up to testify, we'll close out the public hearing on Senate Bill 262, and we'll get it scheduled for a work session soon. Okay. I'm going to open up a public hearing on SJR 23. Chris, can you give us an introduction on a bill we've seen this way before?
Yes, good afternoon, Chair House, members of the committee. What SJR 23 does is it amends the Constitution and creates a personal investment in education fund. And what it does is redirects future surplus, i.e. kicker refunds, from personal income taxpayers into the fund. The resolution would direct money to be spent on K-12 funding with priority to certain projects, seismic rehabilitation programs, and student behavioral health counseling. It would also require a 3/5 majority in each chamber to appropriate funds, and would apply to biennium beginning on or after July 1, 2019. There's also a background one sheet page on the kicker that shows the history of the kicker since inception in 1980, as well as the currently projected kicker of $748 million. And I've included at the bottom of that it's not really a revenue impact, but it's a bar chart of the current forecast for the non-corporate general fund. And it basically shows the 2% threshold. This is the kicker. Conceptually, it's kind of the kicker threshold for each of the next biennia.
I see.
as to how much that would be. So picking 21, 23, that threshold, if that forecast weren't to change and that becomes the official forecast for that biennium, the threshold would be about $475 million, just to try and give some sense of where we would hit that. Given the nature of the kicker, it's certain over the 30-year history of the kicker, it doesn't kick every biennium, so it's mm-hmm. it's sporadic. So it certainly wouldn't have that impact. It wouldn't be expected to have that impact every biennium.
Okay, Senator Manning has been here waiting patiently, and Senator Taylor, you're also listed as a sponsor of this legislation, so I'll let him go first. And
no, I wasn't planning on testifying. I'm so glad that Senator Manning is here to testify.
Thank you. Chair Hass, Vice Chair Bence, Senators Riley, Oquist, Taylor, thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is James Ivory Manning, Jr. I am Senator from Senate District 7, which is Northwest Eugene, Bethel, Santa Clara, up to Junction City. I come to testify today in full support of SJR 23, which proposed a constitutional amendment to redirect the tax kicker surplus to a personal investment education fund. This fund will be distinct from the general fund, retain interest accrued, will provide funding for K-12 education in Oregon with priorities given in seismic upgrades and behavioral health counseling. These needs are dire in Oregon. The Oregon Office of Emergency Management has stated that there is a 37% chance that our state will experience a large earthquake within the next 50 years, which will render us without service or assistance for at least 2 weeks. We need to offer more resources to retrofit our buildings and the buildings that our children learn in. The need to increase the access to behavior counseling has been highlighted in policy recommendations by the Student Success Committee work group. Parents, educators in my district have shared countless stories of how under-resourced K-12 counseling disrupts learning and students need extra support. According to Oregon Department of Education, counseling accounting for less than 2% of K-12 payroll. We need to do better. Redirecting the kicker is a small price to pay to ensure the safety and education of our children. Although the average kicker in 2015 was $227, the medium kicker, which is better estimated given income inequality, was just $89. Should SJR 23 pass, Oregonians will be able to decide for themselves whether they agree with the redirection of the kicker in the next primary election. I urge your I vote on SJR 23 to give Oregonians a choice to kick the kicker to K-12 education. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Manning. Do we have any questions? Senator Taylor, did you want to expand on?
Oh, I wanted to, again, Senator Manning brought this bill forward, and we talked about it, and I think that this is a great idea. There are some other bills out there about redirecting the kicker, either in this session or in the future, but I think it's something that we should be seriously considering.
Mr. Chair, I would like to thank Senator Taylor for support of the bill as well. And just to add, I've talked to a lot of business leaders in my community, and they have expressed to me that they really don't need the kicker. You know, they're wondering why they're doing it, why they're getting it. And here we have an opportunity to do something good for the children.
Thank you, Senator. Appreciate you coming down here.
Thank you for having me.
We do have some people signed up to testify on this bill.
Shocking.
Representative Dreesen, I did not see you.
I'm small.
You're small and you're new, but that's no excuse.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Chair Haas, Vice Chair Benz, members of the committee, for the record, I am State Representative Christine Dres, and I represent House District 39. And I am here, regrettably and respectfully, in opposition to SJR 23. I just testified alongside Senator Manning in support of paying for our ballots with public funding, and here I am opposing SJR 23. So I guess that's just how this business works. So the kicker was intended and has successfully controlled the growth of Oregon state government for many years. Since it was approved by voters in 1980, as you know, the kicker has returned to taxpayers $3.4 billion through this mechanism. And in 2000, Oregonians overwhelmingly voted to protect the kicker in the Oregon Constitution. On 10 separate occasions, the kicker has ensured that excess tax dollars taken in by our state have been returned to taxpayers. To be sure, this has provided tax relief, but its greatest strength is to serve as one of the only programs that keeps the growth of government in check. And as you guys all know, we continue to experience shortfalls based on the erratic sources of funding that we have in our state. And keeping growth in government year on year is actually a very important mechanism that we need to continue to preserve and protect. While this proposal does not eliminate the kicker, it dedicates the kicker to another reserve fund. Oregon has multiple reserve funds, including a rainy day fund dedicated to education. This proposal creates a new fund that, in my opinion, is overly restrictive, unnecessary, and duplicative. We are constitutionally required to balance our budget, everybody, as you guys know, and everyone works on. And if estimates come in above the adopted amount, we can still maintain that initial 2% towards our budget in the following year. And beyond that amount, of course, it triggers this kicker. But at the close of session, we do have a balanced budget. And so the kicker works. It serves its intended purpose of controlling the growth of government, and it provides tax relief to Oregon families. And I urge you and encourage you not to put the kicker in a separate side account once again and to instead oppose SJR 23. Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions?
Thank you for your time.
Sorry we didn't notice your write-off.
Thank you.
That won't happen again.
We do have some people signed up. Tootie Smith and Lou Ogden. Why don't you come up together? Lou Ogden. Come on up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Respectfully, Senator Taylor from my county in Clackamas. I'm Tootie Smith, former county commissioner, representing the Taxpayers Association of Oregon, and we are in opposition respectfully to what we consider an attempt by lawmakers to steal the kicker from ordinary taxpaying Oregonians. We are not taking it away from businesses. For 35 years, the kicker has served as a control to keep government in check. Government has been growing faster than the rate of inflation, and the population of Oregon, as submitted in our testimony, I too have a graph, and it's quite representative of what we think government spending is doing in Oregon in relation to the population and taxes. The problem is government spending, and the kicker is the only last remaining tools to make government live within its means in the state of Oregon, just like families have to. Oregon taxpayers have kept their promise every year by paying their taxes to the government. We ask in return that the government keep their promise of returning to the kicker to the Oregonians who pay that. It is only fair. And for 35 years, that's a promise that I think bodes well in a time when all of us in government are viewed not in the most positive light or eyes. Oregon taxpayers, the Oregon kicker law has been affirmed by voters twice for a vote, and it is constitutional. And one of the reasons why I think the kicker is such a large target, because it's a large amount of money. Because a huge amount of money and revenues have been paid to the state of Oregon, because Oregon is on an uphill growth, but because of that, we must keep government in check and live within its means, just like the taxpayers of Oregon. And thank you kindly for listening to me today.
Mr. Ogden.
Thank you, Chair House, Vice Chair Benson, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lou Ogden. I'm the executive director of Unified Business Oregon. Unified Business Oregon is a member-supported business advocacy organization. Our objective is to represent interests of business to be a reliable and consistent voice for supporting business throughout the state of Oregon. I'm going to repeat a little bit of what's been said, but as you know, in 1980, Oregonians overwhelmingly approved the kicker tax rebate as a mechanism to put spending controls on state government, as been mentioned. And then when lawmakers swept the personal kicker in the 1990s, Oregonians voted to enshrine the kicker in the state constitution in the year 2000. Though Oregonians then supported later directing the corporate kicker to pay for schools in 2012, they strongly opposed lawmakers keeping the personal kicker. I've got some polling information that statewide polling of 950 likely Oregon voters commissioned by Unified Business Oregon, UBO, in February of this year, and found that 72.9%, nearly three-fourths, of Oregonians support the kicker tax rebate law in the Constitution. This poll had respondents that was actually oversampled of Democrats and female voters. And when asked if Oregonians would support lawmakers keeping the kicker this session to shore up the state's budget deficit, over two-thirds, 68.9% of Oregonians would not support using the personal kicker tax rebate to apply toward the general fund budget. And lastly, when Oregonians were asked if they would support a referendum to overturn the legislature's decision, or in essence claw back the kicker were it taken in this session, almost 58% of those surveyed said they would support a referendum to claw back the kicker if it was taken by the legislature. Realize that today's hearing is not to take the kicker, but to refer to the voters a constitutional amendment. But certainly this polling, if people are willing to vote to claw back the kicker if it's taken, certainly it doesn't indicate their support for permanently eliminating it. The kicker tax rebate is the only real break, as has been said, on government spending upon which taxpayers can rely. Multiple news outlets, as you know, have reported in the last several years cost drivers include the need for more revenue, that is PERS, and actually skyrocketing public health employee health care costs, as all health care costs throughout sectors. So we understand that PERS changes are prospective, but unfortunately, measures to make substantive prospective changes have not received any hearings in this building. The Eugene Register Guard has reported that Oregon pays more for public employees' health care costs than other states in the Western region. Plans to move public employees to CCOs or onto the health care exchange as a way to bring down costs have not been entertained. We would like to recommend that before we break faith with the voters and make promises that the kicker money would reach the classroom by reducing class sizes or extending school years, we would ask that we address the systemic cost drivers. Kicker revenues are a one-time fix. You know, in a booming economy, kickers create government growth. In a down economy, that becomes current service level. And then we claw to find revenue to support the new current service level in a down economy. It's a stepwise up procedure. It never has a ratcheting down. Briefly, over 400,000 businesses file their business income tax on their personal tax return. The legislature disconnected these same businesses last year from the federal tax code, creating a $1 billion tax increase over three biennia. Small businesses also had their health care taxes raised just recently in HB 2010. And the 2013 small business tax rate change is currently under attack in this session, or there's rumor to that effect. The kicker tax rebate is the only mechanism that personal income tax business filers have to bring any sort of parity relative to C corporation tax rates. So for those reasons, we urge you to stand strong with Oregon small business and the majority of Oregonians who are opposed to the legislature's attempt to repeal or otherwise suspend the personal kicker tax rebate, and would suggest that this referral for a constitutional amendment would not be supported by the voters and is probably not worth the time and effort and expense.
I would personally object to your using the words like take back and steal. This is just a proposal to refer this to voters.
Correct. So,
any questions? Senator Riley.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, both of you used the this to say the voters use this to control the size of government, and yet they voted to let us take the business side of it. So apparently, if it's somebody else's, it doesn't need to control the size of government, but if it's theirs, it does need to control the size of government. Is that what I understand?
Is that directed to me?
Either one of you.
I think Mr. Ogden's poll is quite accurate. Taxpayers are not wanting to pay any more personal income tax, and that's what we're addressing here today is the personal income tax.
Chair Hass, Senator Riley, I think another thing to consider, and I can't speak for the voters other than the poll that we just shared in terms of what they were thinking, 7 years ago, when they voted to take the corporate kicker and put it into education. But I think there has been a lot transpire in the last 7 years about the cost of government, particularly as it relates to PERS and relating to other issues that may change the thinking of the electorate as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bennett Mitten.
Haas, Vice Chairman Vance, members of the committee, Senator Taylor. My name is Bennett Minton, and I speak today on behalf of Tax Fairness Oregon, which, as you know, is a group of volunteers who get together, read bills, and advocate for an equitable and rational tax code. TFO applauds any measure that would make appropriate use of the kicker, an irrational, counterproductive constitutional provision. The kicker relies unrealistically on the forecasting abilities of state economists, and more importantly, it exacerbates macroeconomic cycles to the detriment of Oregon. The diversion of the kicker into a proposed personal investment and education fund is better policy than returning it to taxpayers. The value individuals may attach to their kicker tax credits is dwarfed by the harm to the state and its people during recessions. We assume the intention of creating the education fund is to focus on the political priority of the moment. Various measures show that the quality of our schools has collapsed in the 3 decades since taxpayers began constricting your means of raising revenue. Rather than tie its own hands, we would prefer that the legislature approve the broadest possible use of the revenue and without specifying in the Constitution how it should be spent. We assume the designation of the revenue for a narrow purpose is a play for votes from legislators and citizens, but we know that priorities change. TFO opposes subjecting any expenditure to a fundamentally undemocratic supermajority requirement. Creating additional 40% plus one stipulations within the legislative assembly would continue a practice in which a minority rules for a category of otherwise routine expenditures. We understand the politics that have guided Oregon's leaders since the 1990s. A number of citizens have submitted statements opposing SJR 23 for today's hearing. But we suggest that recent trends, particularly the results of last year's elections, indicate that citizens recognize that they have enfeebled Republican government and that they are prepared for you to bear the responsibilities of your office, to govern with a simple majority in the best interests of Oregonians, especially those who are too young to vote. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Marcia Kelly.
Chair Hass, Vice Chair Benson, members of the committee, I'm Marcia Kelly, public policy advocate for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. We've been advocating for kicker reform for as long as I've been in the building, at least. And the idea of putting it into a fund for education is commendable. I do have concerns about tying it constitutionally to two particular means of funding, because it does, priorities change, other things change, and so putting something into the Constitution saying this is what it would be spent on is not a good idea. The other thing that I want to remind Oregonians is that the state did not overcharge you on your taxes. This is a situation where the state economist has to predict 26 months ahead what money is going to come into the state through our income tax system. And there are many things that happen that affect that prediction. As an example, some global situation that would either make it higher or lower, and the tax bill that they passed at the federal level in 2017, which happened after the close of session forecast. It's not good policy. We have it. I would encourage really telling Oregonians that it's not that more money came in than it, and that we took too much money away from them. It's the fact that the economist has a difficult job and cannot adequately predict what's going to be in Oregon's household budget.
Thank you, Marcia. Patrick Castles.
Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue, thank you for having me here and allowing me to speak. I didn't know when I came here that I was going to speak before members of the enfeebled Republican government. As one of the prior speakers mentioned, I have much more faith in you than that. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak on SJR 23. It is easy to see that SJR 23 is consequential legislation for every Oregon taxpayer. I must say for me, and I believe many other Oregonians, the reduction in the kicker, which is the subject of this bill, will be not only a financial blow, but a breach of faith should it be enacted into law. As a lifelong Oregonian and long-term taxpayer, I'm dismayed by the actions of the legislature to diminish the return of the money which I and many others have earned. Record revenues to the state of Oregon should be used wisely and fairly. But I must express my sense of injustice in that on top of all the numerous taxes that Oregonians pay must be added the excess and the projection that we know as the kicker. There's been a criticism that the kicker is an inefficient rebate to the people. I believe that that is the choice of the people to make. Changing a longstanding law on which the people have depended as both a symbolic and good faith effort by the legislature to control its spending is an important symbol indicating that the legislature is capable of being an honest broker and disciplined steward of the state's financial resources. You have a chance to do the right thing and reinforce transparency and justice by opposing the reduction in the kicker, not just for the sake of boosting our state's economy. After all, some of the money will be returned to you as revenue when it is spent, but for some, it may be a lifeline to sufficient food or utility bills. I was born in the state of Oregon, expect to die in the state of Oregon, and for that reason, I believe I have a great stake in the future of our state. The kicker not only stands for good government, but keeping the faith of the people who plan on it and rely on it in the appropriate years. Please oppose this destructive measure, which affects so many of our fellow citizens. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Castles.
I have no one else signed up to testify. I'll close out this public hearing on SJR 23, and we've reached the end of our agenda. We'll be back tomorrow to discuss reconnect and connect, our favorite subject. So with that, we are adjourned for the day.